The program this month is Black Lives Matter. Keontae, tell us how it's going to start. I understand that the first thing will be a discussion of the creation and formation of Jim Crow in the Pensacola area. And there's a lot of backstory here.
There is. And what's important for people to know is while in other parts of the country where people saw for white only signs and were not allowed to vote or sit at lunch counters, that movement happened a little bit different here in the city of Pensacola. And so our co-panelist, Tiende Broughton, will be talking about what that looked like here in the city of Pensacola, but also connecting it to the national narrative of Jim Crow.
Now let's move to your specific focus, and that is talking about the national narrative and getting into the shootings of black civilians across the country and the formation of the Black Lives Matter movement. As I understand it, Black Lives Matter stemmed from the 2012 shooting of Trayvon Martin. Let's start there.
It did. And, you know, it's interesting that people think of Ferguson when it actually is a home. It's from Florida, right? It grew out of Sanford, Florida, and the killing of Trayvon Martin. And so, yes, the Black Lives Matter movement is one that focuses on justice, but isn't just about criminal justice. It's about justice across the board for people of color, particularly African Americans. And so what I'll be doing on Thursday is giving a brief history lesson on the Black Lives Matter movement and making sure that people really understand that this is a movement. This is not one event, one singular event. This isn't about just Michael Brown or just Trayvon Martin or just Sandra Bland. That this is a movement, and this is this generation's civil rights movement, and they're coming to it unapologetically, authentically as they are. This isn't about, you know, being in three-piece suits and marching in the streets, but this is being in the t-shirts and the Crocs and coming to the movement into the streets with civil disobedience and protest, calling for justice for black people.
One of the issues I think that a lot of people have with the Black Lives Movement is that it has been overshadowed at times by violence and acts of vandalism. Can you talk more about that?
You know, violence is the language of the oppressed. And while I don't condone it, and I'm pretty sure that most in this country do not, it is the language of the oppressed. And what many, particularly young black people in some of our inner cities or very rural communities at that, are saying is that we feel oppressed. We feel like we have no voice. And when I cannot speak, when I get that opportunity, I'm going to yell. And so I think what's important for people to acknowledge is that for too long, while yes, we have a black president, yes, we have elected officials who are African-American, we have the opportunity to go to school and to pretty good schools for the most part, that there is still institutional racism alive. And young people are experiencing that every day in their lives when they walk out of their doors and interacting with law enforcement, going to some of them to schools that are not the best of schools in their communities, and they feel like they have no voice. And when they have their brother, their sister, their cousin laying in the ground dead, they're screaming, and they're screaming out, look at me, value me, I am human, and I have a voice.
All right, but I still think that a lot of people have a problem with, I mean, it's like two wrongs don't make a right. And a lot of people have an issue with the violence and some of the killings that have happened during these protests.
Well, you know, I think we've got to always be able to put some things into context and perspective. During the Jim Crow civil rights movement, we had people who engaged in violence against African Americans. And then we had race riots, right? And so history oftentimes repeats itself. And so we can't cast such a bad light on this generation when we know in situations like this, whether it's the hate that fell upon Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, or the race riots that destroyed cities like Detroit or Baltimore, LA or Chicago, history repeats itself when we don't stop to deal with the hate and oppression that's in a community.
We kind of touched on the police shootings. You mentioned Michael Brown, Eric Garner, police-related death. Help us to understand how these incidents across the country, along with social media, help to spread this movement.
I think the great thing that young people are bringing to this movement is a national platform through social media. And so now we don't have to wait for major news outlets to show us violence or the things that happen in the evening in those small cities on national TV. It's a text, a tweet. It is instantaneous. And we've actually sadly seen the death of people live on social media in the world. We'll never get that image out of our heads. And so what's important is that we move from that instantaneous death and that image to then using technology like body cameras to actually help us get to a point of justice so that we aren't just watching something bad happen, but we're using those tools, that technology, to also hold those assailants accountable.
Reverend Julie,
yes.
You will be facilitating this evening discussion. Talk about what you will add to it. We were just really having a discussion here about the Black Lives Matter movement and whether or not it means you're anti-police, and that's what you're going to bring to the conversation.
Yeah, I think it's such an important conversation to have, and the instantaneous nature of social media has created a whole new dynamic in our country. Some people think that because we're seeing things now and hearing hateful rhetoric now on a almost continuous basis, that it's happening more now than it has in the past. But I don't personally agree with that. I think that it's been happening all along, and that there are a lot of people, especially comfortable white people, whose lives are not affected in the same way by a lot of the institutional bias that happens regularly in African American communities across our country. They have a hard time believing that this can actually happen. But the prevalence of especially the video recordings of encounters, especially between unarmed Black people and the police force, which is sworn to serve and protect, there's just a lot of questions being raised, and it's awkward for a lot of people who want to have trust in our police force, and we do need to have that trust. But in a lot of communities, there is not a level of trust that needs to be there.
And so, in your opinion, if you support and understand Black Lives Matter, you're not necessarily saying, I totally distrust the police and I'm anti-police.
Absolutely. You know, we recognize that the police have a very difficult job in our country. It's gotten progressively harder to do, especially with poverty and the lack of access to mental health and the lack of access to education and employment. You know, they're kind of forced into a really difficult situation, and they are seen in the media as being on the front line. But really, my understanding of the Black Lives Matter movement, like Yante said, is that it's not just the police. It involves the whole criminal justice system, which we know statistically treats people of color differently than people of European descent for this exact same crimes. And so there's a lot of awareness that needs to happen.
What's the term? The kind of bias, implicit bias.
Implicit bias.
So we really are talking that for a lot of people, there is that implicit bias that exists, and we may act a certain way, have a certain reaction, do a certain thing, not consciously.
Right. We don't notice it. And I'd like to give an example that I've thought a lot about this. Of course, this whole series of deaths of unarmed African Americans has been so troubling. And I think it really does bring attention to well-meaning white people who are genuinely concerned and confused by it. But there are a couple of examples that I think, in terms of understanding implicit bias, that might help some of our listeners. And one is the situation of Tamir Rice, 12-year-old boy in a Cleveland park playing with his older sister. the police receive a call and the caller says there's a weapon. I'm not sure if it's a real one or not. And to rush in without any verbal de-escalation or even assessment. And the reason why I think this is like a really important situation to look at, two things. One is that if that same thing had happened to a 12-year-old white boy in Cleveland playing with his older sister, I can guarantee you that the white community would be enraged and would really call into question the actions of the officers, regardless of what color or race, you know, the officers were. If you just look at two officers arriving on the scene and pulling a weapon on a juvenile without any assessment of the situation, and if it had been a white young boy, the reaction would have been very different. And that's part of the implicit bias. When white listeners hear a story like that, and part of it is we're bombarded with stories of the dangerousness of young African American men. And unfortunately, we become desensitized to the actual details of the situation.
Before we move on, I understand that Haley Morissette, who is a leader of the Black Lives Movement in Pensacola, will be talking about and helping us to understand better what this is.
Well, yes. Haley Morissette, Katrina Ramos, myself, and a few others, after the non-indictment of the officer who killed Mike Brown, we started a group called From Pensacola with Love. And it really gets to that question one of implicit bias. We said bias isn't necessarily prejudice. We're not aware of it. And so if we can met that violence with love, then we can start conversations and obviously move past that bias. And so we started a group called From Pensacola with Love, and we've been calling attention to many of those racial biases that we still see prevalent in our community today. And so my good friend and partner, Haley, will be talking about, you know, what does All Lives Matter mean in that context of Black Lives Matter. And I think it's important for people to understand that what we saw in New Orleans, actually, last year when a young white man was killed by two African-American police officers, it was the Black Lives Matter movement that told the world that that happened. It was not the All Lives Matter movement. It was not the I Trust Blue or I Love Blue movement signs that we see out. Although all of those things, taking the hashtag away, I think we would all subscribe to, you put the hashtag in front of it and it means something slightly different. But I say all that to say that it was, in fact, the Black Lives Matter movement that said, if one of us hurts, we all hurt. And if we can acknowledge that this is an atrocity, that a life was taken unnecessarily by law enforcement, that of a young white man, then how can we then ignore that killing of a young black man? Similar situation in North Carolina this past summer when a handicapped white guy was killed by police in a routine traffic stop. And now we've got laws in North Carolina going up for the governor to sign about de-escalation and training for police officers. Yet we don't see that in states like Ohio. We don't see that in states like Florida, where we've seen countless African-American men killed or even harmed. We have the images of the social worker laying in the street with his hands up out of Miami saying, "Don't shoot me," and the officer still proceeds to shoot him. Where's the legislation behind that? We don't see it. And so what the Black Lives Matter movement is saying is not that all lives don't matter, but if we can acknowledge that Black Lives Matter too, then we can all rise and really put forth a strong effort to make sure that justice prevails in all situations.
And finally, as we close, I know this is a community workshop, community conversation. What do you guys hope will come out of these workshops?
Well, one of the things that I have been touched by in my career very dearly is the legacy of Reverend James Reeb in Selma, who was killed after Martin Luther King put out a call to white sympathizers to come and be a part of the movement. James Reeb came.
A Unitarian minister.
Sadly lost his life while in Selma because of hate. And so what I'm calling, and hopefully for helping people do here in the city of Pensacola, is this is a call to not act but a call to love and to act on that love, and will come and be a part of this conversation and be like the James Ream of the world who said, what can I do to help support this movement? How can I offer myself and my voice to a movement so that we don't continue to have these conversations 40, 50, 60 years from now of talking about the racial inequalities in this country?
And Julie?
I really do believe that we are in a new civil rights movement era, and that even though we did through a collaboration with African Americans and white Americans during the civil rights struggle, like James Reeb and many others, accomplish important legislation, the fact is that the quality of life for African Americans in our country is nowhere near we thought what it would be by now. And one of the reasons why I personally feel that the attention to the killings of unarmed black people at the hands of the police is such an important issue, and how not only is it traumatic for the African American community to be subjected to being able to see it visually, but to have case after case go through the criminal justice system without accountability. And what it does at a deeper level is it builds on, unfortunately, a really difficult part of our national past when lynchings were common. They weren't done just by extremist hate groups like the KKK. They happened in a lot of places, not just the South, also in the North. And the perpetrators were never brought to justice, and a lot of white communities participated and condoned it. And when our national attention sees case after case of unarmed African Americans in particular, but other people too, where the police are not held accountable, what it means, and sometimes people say it, but it goes mainly unsaid, is that we accept state-sanctioned violence against our own citizens. And that's a moral tragedy. It's not where we should be, and we have to come to terms with it. And it's not just the police. The police are representing a larger system and the laws, the legislation, and it's the local communities that not only enforce the sentencing standards, but also accept the unequal access to democratic resources that we see in African American communities, from housing to education to employment. So it's a systemic problem, and unfortunately, it's a uncomfortable one for white people to be in a conversation. I think it's really important, and I think that part of being in the conversation is just showing up and being willing to listen to a perspective that's different than your own. And honor that just because it's not my experience doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Ladies, thank you.